Hold on. I gotta die a little.
Please do, on air.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from California, you are Cassidy Robinson. We do, sure. even when we're not on the podcast, we argue.
This is true. I think actually we do our best disagreeing to agree off air.
Yeah, we usually are a little meaner on air. I don't know why.
You think we're meaner on air?
Sometimes, yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, I mean, I think we're blunter, but I don't know. Maybe we're more self-conscious because we're, like, in front of a crowd. So we're like, you slighted me, fool? Like, I don't know. I'm not sure.
I will not take this disrespect.
Yeah, so when it's just, like, us talking, we're like, oh, he's just an a-hole.
Mm-hmm. We're recording later than usual and a day earlier than usual for various reasons. Does it feel different? Does it feel like... I don't know. This used to be our regular time. How do you feel?
I feel okay. No, it's fine. I don't know. I prefer the nighttime, but you know.
Right. You love the nightlife.
I am.
I love the nightlife. I love to boogie.
We're going to be reviewing Nightcrawler, finally. We were going to last week, but this week we finally are. And we will also be talking about Interstellar, of course. And at the end of the show, we're going to be talking about The American Scream.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it's called?
That is what it's called.
Because in my show notes here, I have written Haunted House Movie because I've forgotten what it was called.
There's like several of those documentaries, so that would be confusing.
Yeah. Last week, or not last week, but a couple days ago, I sold all of my single issue comic books.
That's sad. Sad day.
Eh.
Oh, you should have just burned them in a pile in your front yard then.
Well, I wanted money, so that wouldn't have been an option.
So you did it in your soul, you burned them on ice.
Right. Cool. You gave yours away. You didn't even sell them.
No, I have mine still.
You have most of them?
I don't have them here with me, but I have them, yeah.
Oh, okay. Now, I didn't have all that many. I collected very few titles for just a few years in the mid-2000s. So I have one long box basically full of, you know, a few different things. And I went to Fat Collectibles down here in Anaheim, and they gave me a price. They're willing to take almost all my Batman, had no interest in my X-Men.
Hmm.
And,
Well, when was your Batman single issues? When were they?
It was like at the tail end of Judd Winnick, and then when it went into Grant Morrison's run.
Okay, that makes
sense.
And
it went up to the point in which RIP started.
Yeah. Okay. See? So I think yeah, there's a reason for it. Whereas right. Didn't you have like a lot of like Exiles and
yeah, I had a bunch of Exiles, and then I had I was collecting just the regular X-Men title, which was like the least interesting X title at the time.
Was it the Chris Claremont one?
I think he may have done a little run on it, not for way long.
Okay.
It was kind of a on and off title. Like people would just kind of jump on. It's pretty much there just to, so that they can create crossover events and that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
But it was and then I did have a lot of the Joss Whedon run on Astonishing X-Men, which I would have thought would have been my most valuable stuff, but people were not as excited about that as I thought they would be.
Huh. That is interesting. I thought they'd have more of that, but
yeah. But anyway, so I ended up going to a place down in Orange, a brand new shop that just opened by the school, and I felt like I was in an episode of that Comic Book Men.
Okay.
because they're kind of looking at me, and it's like I could hear like the cheesy music that they add in post, like the doom doom, to like create dramatic pauses.
And it's just a dude staring at a dude.
It's really like three dudes staring at each other, and then they're staring at me, and they're like, you could tell they want to have like this in-depth conversation about how little they need to pay me.
Uh-huh.
But I was just standing there, and they're like, well, how much do you think is worth? I was like, well, I've it's been appraised at $200 once. I'd be happy with $150. And then, you know, dramatic pause. They're like staring at each other. It's like, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly in the middle of a comic book store. And then, finally, they worked me down to $75.
Oh. So basically that they
won.
For
the whole box, yeah.
Okay. Well, it's not so bad, actually. I mean, it crushes my soul, but as long as your soul feels fine.
Well, I mean, a lot of the best stories that were in there,
mm-hmm.
the stuff that I really liked, I ended up buying in trade anyway.
Right.
And then anything that I got signed at Comic-Con forever ago, I kept.
Oh, that's nice. So, well, okay, so you're not one of those eBay guys. That's good.
No, I mean, I might try and sell those at some point, but I'm going to wait till they ripen.
Till they ripen. I'm against you as a person right now. No, my exciting story for the week is I bought sweats, so.
Sweatpants?
Yeah, sweatpants.
Congratulations.
Hey, thank you. Thank you.
It is getting sweatpants time of the year.
Yeah, and they're pretty nice ones. They're Puma. Mm-hmm. But I bought them at the Burlington Coat Factory, so I can be fancy like rich people from 5 years ago.
Right.
I stole that joke from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I just want everyone to know.
Oh, okay. Never mind. I recall that laugh then.
That's okay. I had to. It's like quoting. You gotta, you know. You gotta.
Why you're like promoting like 700 things at once, like Puma, It's Always Sunny, and Burlington Coat Factory.
I'm getting a kickback, yeah.
Like I feel like I'm in an episode of The Truman Show right now.
You are.
What's your favorite hot chocolate brand?
Swiss Miss.
All right, let's go ahead and get into the show. And we're going to do a couple news items here. Let's go ahead with your first one.
My first one?
Mm-hmm.
Fine. Toy Story is happening again for the fourth time.
Right.
Another news, Toy Story 4 will hit theaters in 2017. Apparently John Lasseter is coming back on, the head of Pixar, and he's going to be directing it.
He wrote and directed the first two, I think, or he was a co-writer, along with Joss Whedon and a few other people, of the first one, and, he's, you know, it's his baby, it's his world.
Well, he also did the Cars movies, apparently. I didn't know that. I know nothing of those movies. So.
I don't either. Those I've never seen them. I had no interest.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard very good things about them either. But yeah, those... I mean, you're not as into the Toy Story movies as I am, or I think a lot of people are. But I kind of feel like that series ended really nice. Like, it had a good... I think it's actually one of the most consistent trilogies of all of cinema.
Right.
And if you just look at the arc of those stories and how one flows into the other, actually Toy Story 3 made me like Toy Story 2 more, because it sort of like fit in with as a trilogy better than it did as a single film or as just a sequel. And I felt like it feels like a really good contained three act story, those three movies. I don't really know where they're going to go into this. And what I said on our Facebook page, if you're not following us there, it's facebook.com/jabberpodcast.
Who's promoting now? Oh, wait, that's us. That's fine. You can promote that.
What I said there is I feel like if they have to get this out of their system, if they need to keep making Toy Story movies, why not just further explore this world, go to somebody else's bedroom, and create new characters, and you could like do newer toys and blah, 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 rather than going back to Buzz and Woody, but apparently that's not what they're
going to
do.
Well, no, what it said they were going to do is they're basically the two that are coming from the old series is Buzz and Woody, but all the other toys are new.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if
they're... So somewhere in the middle.
So they're doing somewhere in the middle of what you don't want them to do specifically and what you want them to do. So that's not bad, really.
I will say this, though. I had the same reservations about Toy Story 3 before it came out.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, do we really need another Toy Story? Why not? Why not we get this Incredibles 2 off the ground, which is the sequel everybody's been clamoring for, instead of going back to the well for Toy Story. And then they ended up making, like, you know, a much better film than I could have imagined them ever doing for the third time around. So maybe they have a story they really need to tell, and maybe it will live up to the other three.
Well, and it does seem like he's not doing this kind of like, we need to pump out another Toy Story so we can make some money, honeys. Like, it doesn't seem like John... That's my John Lasseter voice.
That's exactly what he sounds like, too. It's actually uncanny.
Yeah, I know. I think it's... at least they've always appeared fairly sincere, except for Planes and Cars to me. Cars 2, specifically.
Yeah.
But, I mean, other than that, I mean, I don't know. I'm really... I've never been into the whole Pixar thing except for Up and Wall-E. That's my type of Pixar. And so, I mean, that's the stuff I want them to make. I don't know. My true opinion of Toy Story 4 is, I don't care. but I'm doing a lot of voices.
Yeah, you have like a lot of characters in you right now.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see what keeps happening with this podcast.
By the end, I'll be an old British man.
Right. Okay, well, my other story here, Oliver Stone, is planning on directing a documentary about, Russian President Vladimir Putin, sitting Russian president.
How high is Oliver Stone going to get to do this? That's my only question ever for his stuff.
For his movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably a medium.
Oh, okay.
You know. Not like Natural Born Killers high or The Doors high, but maybe like a Nixon.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it is a documentary, so it isn't going to be a narrative film or a biopic where somebody
has done many documentaries. Like, I'm not familiar with that. I mean, I know he did Natural Born Killers, but I can't say that I'm well versed on Oliver Stone.
Well, he was the. Apparently, he was the producer on that Edward Snowden documentary. That's why he was in, I'm reading this off the Hollywood Reporter, that's why he was in Russia, was to oversee that. And then he met Putin briefly and was like, you're my next documentary subject. So maybe he's just going to be on more as a producer, or he could be directing it. I don't know. Things are a little, how we say, prickly with us and Russia at the moment.
I just think of him on a horse without a shirt on because of
all the memes.
Yeah, mostly the memes. Isn't it on the John Oliver show or whatever?
Yeah, he showed the picture at one point.
Oh, okay. So that was a meme beforehand.
Yeah, I think every political satirist who was anything worth their salt was going to show that picture.
Well, you know, he's a beautiful man with his shirt off on a horse, so.
Right. And he's also a little intimidating, and I think he knows that, and I think he sort of likes being known as an intimidating figure. I don't know what kind of angle this documentary is going to go at, but if it's Oliver Stone, who tends to milk for controversy. So we'll see what that ends up being.
maybe it's more exciting because Oliver Stone is maybe doing a documentary. I don't know.
Yeah. Of a sitting president of a somewhat contentious country.
Maybe it's going to be a reverse propaganda movie for the United States. I don't know.
Possibly. Who knows? Okay, well, let's go ahead and get into our pet topic. We're going to cut the news a little shorter this week since you had a pet topic in mind, and I'll let you ask me what you're going to ask me.
Okay, so in a quick and brief way, what are something that you really actually don't like about movie reviews, or where can a movie review go the most wrong?
Now, what's interesting about this topic is I just wrote a manifesto for a class I'm taking about film criticism. So I have, like, you know, five topics off the top of my head that I could get into about. But those are more about what you should do rather than what you shouldn't, even though saying what you should do implies what you shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think I I think a thing that some film reviewers don't consider, and what I try and take into mind is, you know, one of the things on my manifesto that I stated is that a film critic should be able to accurately describe what a film is and how it makes them feel without conflating or confusing the two.
Okay.
So however you want to interpret that. I guess there are some people who go into a movie, and even if it's doing exactly what the movie is intending it to do,
mm-hmm.
they don't necessarily respond to that emotion.
Right.
Or they don't like having that emotion, and therefore take it out on the film as a negative. And I don't think that happens quite as much as it used to. I'm writing for my thesis. I'm writing about the critical backlash to the films Peeping Tom and Night of the Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a lot about what that happened with those films. But every once in a while, I still see that tendency of, you know, when I hear a review and they tear down the movie for all the reasons, I'm like, I think actually I would, that sounds good to me.
Right.
But maybe that's a good thing. Roger Ebert once stated that a film review, even if he's giving it a negative review, if he's doing his job, it should make the person who would want to see that movie still interested in seeing it.
It kind of challenge, yeah. I mean, we have a very similar opinion on what a review is, and it's mostly just a dialogue.
Right.
I guess where I get the most kind of usually caught up on a review is I've noticed, I didn't know that there was a name for it before until maybe just like a couple of years ago, but nitpicking. I didn't know like what that was, but then I finally was like, So to me, sometimes nitpicking can be like they find, like I've often found that when somebody reviews something and they go for those little things, is they don't
plot
make
holes, or
specifically plot holes. A lot of times they actually, like, the movie actually has already answered that question. It just didn't need to explain it to you.
Right.
And that's, I feel like that often is the real reason. That's what I often see people,
or like little nitpick. Continuity errors that, like, every movie is peppered with continuity errors if you're really looking for them. One that I often, see in movies is the magical growing and shrinking cigarette.
Okay. Right.
If you watch a movie where someone's smoking in a scene and you really pay attention to it, you can tell that it's done with multiple takes because the cigarette is always never the same size from cut to cut.
Well, yeah, because you can't magically, like, stop a cigarette. I guess you could, but it'd be really hard to just stop that cigarette mid-burn.
I mean, yeah, you would have to have a really hardcore continuity supervisor on set. And most of the time, it's just, you know, you're looking for performance. So that little props like that can never take precedent in a scene. And those are the... That's the type of nuance that people like CinemaSins on YouTube doesn't take into account. And
right.
I posted an article a while back about Everything Wrong with the Everything Wrong videos.
Right.
I wish I could credit who wrote that. It might have been AV Club. I think those kind of nitpickisms, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Where people, you know, will build an entire opinion about a movie based upon how many continuity errors they can find, or weird editing cuts, or, you know,
which this is, yeah, it's a production.
Things that have nothing to do with story.
Well, this is a production, and it's honestly, like...
It's an illusion. It's a magic trick.
Yeah, and if you're looking for all of those things, and not, you know, in trying to be like, well, is this realistic? Is this real? Like, sometimes I'm like, that's really not the point. That's not even the point of the film. Well, why did he come back from the dead? Because he does. Just let it go, man.
Just go with it. Because emotionally, that does more for the story than if he doesn't.
I did find I actually found a YouTube one that did the reverse for Prometheus.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like an anti-nitpicket review.
Right.
And it was very interesting. It did kind of make me like the movie more. So
Right. Actually, I mean, I've seen very good analysis of Prometheus on mm-hmm. YouTube, and I'm not, you know, bagging all YouTube critics, or even like, you know, basement bloggers and that type of stuff. There's a lot of really interesting stuff that comes out
of
that.
Well, we are kind of those.
Well, very much so.
Yeah.
We
are that.
So, but yeah, I mean, there is a general kind of swapped of, surface level readings of movies that lead to very, I don't know, I think reductive and silly criticisms.
Fair enough. Like, I'm not talking about like honest trailers, because honest trailers, they're trying to be funny.
Yeah, I think, yeah, more than
theirs
anything,
isn't even a review, really.
No. And neither is CinemaSins per se, but I feel like less of a comedic context there.
Yeah.
And so people tend to look at it as seriousness, and I don't even think they take it that seriously, but
yeah.
I've seen people online use those as like, well, this has a CinemaSins score of 180, therefore it's not a good movie. And I feel like at least the people with honest trailers are having fun with the movie, and like, you know, when they
well, I think late... I think probably like 80 to 90% of the time, I think they like the movies that they that they're nitpicking, you know.
Right.
And I think they've acknowledged that even mm-hmm. through the Captain America 2, the Winter Soldier review one that they did. I honestly do. Like, half the time I'm like, this is done in love. Like, this isn't
yeah.
like, this isn't just like, we will take this apart. The CinemaSins, right. I haven't watched it often just because I'm just,
I watched it a couple of times and I was like, oh, so this is what you do, is you just point out continuity errors. Cool. You're an angry person on IMDb, the YouTube channel.
Fair enough.
I have an opinion about them, if you didn't know. But...
you do have an opinion about them. We've just made an enemy.
I'm fine with that. Is there anything else you wanted to ask about that, or?
No, I wanted it to be brief and pithy for, like I was going to originally make it one-sentence answers, so.
Okay. All right, well, let's go ahead and get into our reviews for the week, and we'll start here with the big release of the season, probably, after last week's total slump of box office sales, we have Christopher Nolan's newest film, Interstellar. And do you want to set that up?
So Interstellar is about a group of explorers that basically basically this planet is failing, and they're looking for another place to be, for a habitable planet for the body of humanity. It stars Matthew McConaughey, who is this father who is living on this planet where they have to basically grow these crops to just basically to survive,
right?
Because a lot of them are failing, and he's just trying to raise his...
probably something like 50 years into the future.
Yes. Well, yeah, that would make sense with John Lithgow's character's age.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be like our generation.
Yeah.
Like actually probably like a 15-year-old from mm-hmm. our generation. And it kind of just, if we keep kind of, it's kind of almost like a warning plus a exploration of what that humanity is uh-huh. and where we're headed in the future, kind of a fantasist kind of take on that almost, but mm-hmm. through more of a science fiction lens. The movie is all about ideas, and it's chock full of them, and it has and there's a lot of different ones, and I think some of them are kind of conflicting, and some of them work a lot better than others.
Okay.
Specifically, I wasn't way into Anne Hathaway character, and her love blah 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 thing that happens towards the middle of the movie.
Right. She's sort of one of the NASA employees who brings on the Matthew McConaughey character, and they try and sort of integrate her into the emotional component in towards the middle of the movie in a way that I don't think really particularly works.
Well, the whole him coming into NASA is kind of convoluted too.
Right.
It's like I mean, there's a lot of things that are very convoluted about this film.
Mm-hmm.
Parts of it are very beautiful, and I think pretty well done and kind of atmospheric. I think about 30 minutes should be cut from this film.
Yeah.
personally.
It's edging right up to 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, just watching it, I can think of 30 minutes I would cut out pretty easily. Mm-hmm. With, you know, minimal rewrites.
I don't think when the content's there and it's working, I don't think it's bad at all. I think it's very good. Yeah. I just think it's bogged down with a lot of extras. It actually does remind me a lot of the Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah. I mean,
not thematically, and there's no Batman.
Right, but... obviously. What I'm gathering from you is basically you have a mixed feeling
I'm not totally there, like...
You're not over the moon over it.
No, it's almost kind of, it's a similar feeling to like Birdman last week.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot about this to really admire and like. He's obviously trying to do his Terrence Malick meets 2001 Space Odyssey thing.
Okay.
He's definitely trying to get away from his kind of almost clinical sterileness of his films, but I don't think he works very good in sentimentality.
I think some of the notes hit
in this very well, but I don't think that when he goes there, it works that well.
I completely agree with you, unfortunately.
You agree with me.
I know. I have a feeling like that's what this podcast is going to be. But, you can definitely tell that he's taken the criticisms of being a cold director very seriously. And he really wanted to throw his hat into the ring of emotional storytelling. Actually, a lot of the story I felt here was kind of him redoing or reworking some of the themes from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Especially the first half of the film when we're still on Earth. And he's, you know, sort of being drawn into this program sort of supernaturally. And then, you know, has to... basically abandon his children. And then the middle of the movie, the second act, is sort of his version of a 2001. And then the third act is sort of his version of a Contact.
There's a lot of stuff. And I even noticed shots specifically that were from Alien, or there was another shot that it was directly from a movie. I was really surprised. And I did see somebody, I can't remember the movie I was thinking of, but I did see somebody online saying that he stole his shots of explaining a wormhole from Event Horizon. And
okay.
I don't think that's true, but...
I mean, it may or may not be. I
just thought it was funny.
When we're talking about this kind of science fiction, this deep space exploration, what's the meaning of it all, the origins of human life, blah, blah, blah. There's 2001 and then there's everybody else. And there's no escaping that. And that's fine.
Or it's Blade Runner and you're everyone else.
Right.
Because I would say that there are certain distinctions.
That's sort of a different paradigm. But I think that it's I'm fine with the movie that it's a pastiche and that it, you know, he's borrowing from the greats and he's kind of doing his version of all those movies. That's not even really my criticism. My criticism is mostly I didn't connect with it emotionally, and the fact that the movie is really aiming for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wouldn't say that I've really connected emotionally with a lot of his movies, but a lot of his movies you don't need to. That was a little bit of a criticism I had over Inception, but Inception more or less is more of a spectacle of a film. And, you know,
it's a heist movie.
It's a heist movie in somebody's mind. Right.
Yeah.
So the emotional component isn't necessarily what's going to hold it all together. Although that is in my opinion, the failing of that movie, if there is one. In this movie, since that is supposed to be the beating heart, literally, of the film, and ties very much in with the themes, this father-daughter story especially, between Matthew McConaughey and his daughter, who's later played by Jessica Chastain in the second half of the movie. Because I didn't really feel 100% connected to that, largely because of the scope and ambition of the plot and the sort of the technicality of the puzzle box construction of it. I was left even more cold and kind of shut out than I normally am at a Christopher Nolan movie.
See, okay, so the Matthew McConaughey and Jessica Chastain stuff, mm-hmm. I mean, even when it was the little girl, that just that whole thread.
It works little bit better when they're on Earth beforehand, when they're cross-cutting.
I see, I disagree. I actually think that's the emotional part that works.
Oh, really?
Is that journey. I don't think anything with Anne Hathaway works. I don't think either. And I saw what they were going for and understood the ideas he was talking about when... Jason Bourne. Gosh.
Oh, we can't do that.
Oh, you think that's...
I think they withheld that on purpose.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess. I mean, I didn't see it that way.
I mean, we can't say that there is a reveal towards the middle of the movie.
There's a reveal that I personally, towards the middle, with a certain character, I don't think works.
I don't either. I didn't understand it when it was a red herring. And mm-hmm. I really didn't understand it when it revealed itself to be what it was supposed to be. I felt like that whole segment was like kind of just this weird shift off into another movie almost.
Agreed. And
it was not a very
really,
interesting one.
And I wasn't really even into the I wasn't even into the performance or anything, which most of the performances were decent in this.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that's something that you would go at this movie about, but...
No.
That one, I certainly was just kind of like, at the middle of the movie, I was just kind of like, okay. But, I mean, all in all, the things that I do like about this film is I do like some of the ideas. It's, you know...
Right.
The whole Rip Van Winkle idea of space... You know, and how relativity works. That was very interesting to me in science class. That's the first thing I thought of when they talked about relativity. I was like, how would it be to go out there? How does time function with our humanity? You know? And when it's exploring that. And so that's why I think the Jessica Chastain and the Matthew McConaughey, I think if you cut all the other extra crap that you don't need in there, those extra players, I think all of that would work very well.
I don't think that that stuff is necessarily bad. I think it's more in the construction of it, because I think once Jessica Chastain's character really kind of takes hold, if I was going to play Script Doctor, I actually feel like a protagonist switch, which they almost kind of tease doing but don't really fully commit to doing, I think a protagonist switch actually would have been more effective, where now we're in... seeing it from her perspective, rather than cross-cutting from the two different situations, and it's crescendoing, crescendoing, and crescendoing to this ultimate climax, because that's what Christopher Nolan feels he has to do now in movies, and I think it's a big problem for a lot of his latter work. I felt like I didn't... It was too fractured for me to really feel like a natural, organic story.
Yeah, and I think we agree with the problem. That's why I said I didn't think all of that was bad. Anne Hathaway character was even bad.
No, she gives a really good performance. I just don't understand what it's doing in the movie.
No, it kind of takes it off on a whole other jaunt. And that's why I'm saying, well, this is the main body. This is what the actual film wants to be about. Mm-hmm. Make it about that.
And a lot of the stuff they're talking about, you know, like their vision of, you know, the near future where corn is basically the only crop we can grow, and that America is no longer the most profitable country anymore, and everyone's kind of getting by on, you know, there's no value in science anymore, like and NASA. All of these ideas are interesting, 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 and I don't think I would ever say that Christopher Nolan is failing for lack of trying.
No. I don't think that the film is a complete failure.
It's just, it's so broad in its scope. It's trying to do so many things at once that it becomes unwieldy, and it doesn't have enough time to really focus in on one of its ideas and really, you know, bring it on home, especially the emotional stuff, which is what's supposed to be driving everything. And I will say, however, though, I mean, it'd be interesting, maybe you saw this with a group or something, but the guy who was sitting next to me, wiping away tears by the end of the movie. Wiping away tears. Totally worked for him. Ashley Hitchcock, a friend of mine, texted me today, told me that she bawled 3 times during the movie. So the emotional stuff is working for some people, but I felt totally iced out of the movie.
I think sometimes it does work. I've already said that. I think that that emotional plot line does work. I'm actually not turned off by him doing it or that it's there.
No, I commend his effort. The whole thing, every character I felt was such a component to this machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And that I knew the plot was going to kind of come back in on itself, and that they were going to answer their own questions, and it was going to do the Christopher Nolan puzzle box thing. And so I never really felt like all the characters, like their motivation was just to serve as a plot function. So mm-hmm. I couldn't really get into them as emotional, fully realized people. Even as good as some of the performances were.
I think Matthew McConaughey, I pretty much was okay there with him.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say of all of the McConaughey's roles, this is like kind of low on the list? I mean, it's better than like, you know, 10 things or How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
If you're talking about performance wise, then yes. If you're talking, I'm talking about the film.
Right, today. Right.
I'm not talking about the actual performance.
No, I'm not saying.
If you're asking me performance, yeah, it's not the most interesting he's done.
No.
But then again, this movie isn't all bad and it's not all good. It's a messy, I don't think fully realized film. I think mm-hmm. that this film needed somebody to tell him no and cut him back.
Yeah. I think it could have desperately needed a rewrite.
I don't think even just a rewrite. I think just somebody in the editing room that said, no, this doesn't work. This is bogging down the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there is, again, to me, it isn't that it needed a rewrite or the ideas aren't good or whatever. There's too much, and some of the threads, they don't mix.
It's like
you're braiding somebody else's hair into a braid.
Right.
And that's just not going to end well because they're going to try to pull their heads together and it's not going to work.
Right.
And so with this film, I actually think he should have gone more sparse with his characters.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need to try to realize so many of them.
I think there could have been less plot. Honestly, I feel like there's so much that the movie has to do, and there's so many places they have to go and stop, and you know, there's all this discussion of the technical science that's going on that, you know, it makes for some cool set pieces, some cool imagery, but it really isn't doing all that much for the story, and it's just kind of slowing things down.
See, I thought that the science stuff was interesting, and
sometimes it was.
I thought it was mostly. I can't remember a moment that actually is what, like, mm-hmm. bothered me. Because for me, most of the time, what it was this thing in our place, and, you know, what humanity's place is amongst it.
Right.
I still feel like, actually, from the movie, it's not cynical. So I really do think that as a filmmaker, he was trying on, like, well, let's be less clinical and less sterile.
Right.
Let's see if I be more emotional. What happens?
There's stuff in the first 45 minutes that is really interesting to see him do at this point in his career. And then I feel like his habits get the best of him. And when it comes to the way he constructs stories and scripts, and it buries itself under its own weight.
See, I haven't heard you. See, again, do you think this is pretty much a failure, or are you on the border?
I think that I was
I put you in a spot.
I haven't officially graded it or whatever. I think it's mostly frustrating and underwhelming.
That's partially expectations at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously. I'm not going into a Christopher Nolan movie expecting much greater things, especially given you know, some of the setup of the movie is really exciting and really well done. And I think he's a talented enough guy that, given as much as he's trying to do here, and I'm quoting some of my conversation that I had via text message earlier today, given all the plates that he has spinning here, he's a talented enough guy that it basically holds together. But I feel like it's at this point, I'm not just giving him an A for effort anymore. He's a grown up, and he's made too many good films to accept mediocrity from him. And I do feel that this is more frustrating than good.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, I'm not there probably, so you're probably a little bit
the
more
good
negative.
Stuff's great.
No,
there,
see,
there's a 100-minute cut of this movie that probably works a lot better, but that's not the movie I saw.
Agreed. And I mean, that's where I'm at. I mean, I'm definitely not giving him an A for effort. I'm giving him, you know, a B minus maybe for effort. But, yeah. I mean, there's still enough in here that I thought was, I definitely didn't want to go and demand my money back from anybody.
No,
or,
certainly not.
And so, I mean, there is some very noteworthy stuff. There is some really, I think some of the best stuff for me anyways was that science was humanity's place within science and where all of that stuff kind of, meshes.
You know what it's not, though?
What?
Fun.
I think I sort of had fun at times, but...
Very briefly. I think a lot of the movie is so self-serious. And it's, you know, I don't know. I don't want him to be a different director. I don't want him to be someone he's not. But I feel like... I don't know. I mean, even the movies he's riffing on, even moments of 2001, which is about as cold and sterile as a movie can be, and about as slow as a movie can be, I think has more sense of awe and wonder than some of the stuff he attempts here.
That's something, that is another thing that I was going to address. I want to see who the cinematographer is. That's what I meant to look up.
Is it not, it's not Wally Pfister, because he was doing...
I don't feel like this film is... yeah.
Hoyt Van Hoytima.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with him, but...
Oh,
he shot Her and Let the Right One In and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, all of which are gorgeous films.
Yes. I don't think it works as well here, though. I think there needs to be more of an atmosphere. And that guy is more of a realist.
Yeah.
Like, he shoots things in a realistic fashion. And this one, while it needs to be real, it still has to have, like you were saying, it needs to have that feeling of awe in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times I felt that, and I was like, I was more in awe, when I was in awe, it wasn't because of the film working on me. It was the ideas working on me.
Okay.
And so I'm not saying that it was badly shot, but what I'm saying is I don't think that he was maybe the right tool to be used in this film with this material specifically.
I mean, I didn't think the visuals were a problem. Maybe that had overall some effect on the tone. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, it's more script issues.
Again, mine's editing.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into our second review of the week, which is last week's Nightcrawler, which came out on Halloween weekend. And to low attendance, I think a lot of people were sort of confused about what this movie was, because it has sort of an ambiguous title. It has nothing to do with the X-Men character.
Right.
And the director is mostly known for writing, does a lot of kind of true crime stuff. Jake Gyllenhaal stars as a sort of antisocial weirdo named Lewis Bloom, who's kind of drifter looking for any work he can get in Los Angeles.
He's sort of a weirdo? Sort of?
Well... You watch and decide. he's looking for any work he can get, and when one night he stumbles upon a car accident on the side of the interstate, and he sees paramedics there helping the people who are hurt, and then he also sees a rogue camera crew getting as much grisly footage as they can get so that they can sell it to the nightly news. This might be a thing that actually happens. I think it. I buy it, given the way that the movie's set up. And he decides he's going to do the same thing. So he gets himself a digital camera. He hires an intern to work for free, basically, and drive him around. And he goes to very strange and increasingly disturbing lengths to get the footage he needs when he needs it, to sell it to kind of a fledgling LA news station ran by Renee Russo, who's doing some of the best work I've seen from her in a really long time. And it's kind of a noir a little bit. It's a little bit sort of a sleazy, underbelly kind of city LA thing, but it's also sort of a meta take on journalistic integrity, and even, I think, to some extent, a movie about movies, because at some points, Gyllenhaal's character starts to create news so that he can have footage to sell, and is sort of directing.
Well, he talks about framing a lot.
Yes.
And and then you notice him, he'll change things for the news to make it more pretty to frame.
Right.
I'm just going to go out and say it. I'm not going to even... I love the movie.
I did,
completely
too.
And utterly. It's great.
Yeah.
It is literally... I mean, in a way, this is the way I would sell it, in like a quick little kind of dumb way. So it's like somebody saw the best parts of Network and the best parts of Taxi Driver and literally made a film and then made it very prescient about this time. I think Jake Gyllenhaal's character, is Louis Bloom, is like every negative like quality of our generation in a lot
right.
of ways.
Yeah.
It just distilled. I'm not saying that that's like, this isn't playing in real land.
No.
The atmosphere of this film reminds me of the painting Nighthawks.
Right.
But just like in a film. And it's about this loner, just like the lone guy at the bar. And so I just,
It's subtly stylish, and it has a look to it, and it feels very much of kind of a... I was actually reminded a lot of sort of the street movies of William Friedkin, both Cruising and The French Connection. Especially, sure. there's a car chase scene in there that's very much inspired by that.
There's a love of 70s film in the film.
All over
sure.
this movie, yes.
I will say I recognized, I don't think it's necessarily something he did on purpose, but you can't help but, because of the style a little bit, think of Drive. But
yeah, I mean, yeah.
And kind of how the character set up, but I think that's because they both have a DNA rooted in Taxi Driver.
Right, well, and Friedkin and a certain kind of L.A. noir style.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah. And they're both, you know, sort of pulpy in their genres. But I think this movie is much more, full of ideas. If we're talking about, you know, going back into, Interstellar, but pulls it off a lot better, because it is more focused and it's character oriented here. And I think that, Gyllenhaal, who, you know, he's lost a bunch of weight for this role. And in my review that I've already written, for this, I said that this is the type of character he's usually hunting down.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's an interesting portrayal of psychopathy, because he does remind you a little bit of like a Patrick Bateman or a Travis Bickle or
Norman Bates, I would say.
Norman Bates at times. Sometimes he reminds me of sort of that get out of my bubble, that constant grin on his face. He kind of reminds me a little bit of De Niro from The King of Comedy And it's a really fantastic performance that I hope gets some kind of recognition, but I feel like this movie is just too cynical and too pulpy for the Academy, and I'm totally fine with that. This is one of my favorite movies of the year. I think this movie gave me a kick in the balls.
Yeah, I loved it. And the thing is, and something that I loved about it too, is so this character, and part of his, like, his just, his being, is he does that power play conversation.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of people, like in the millennials, like do, and it pisses me off. When you're in a business room, go ahead and use it.
Yeah.
But when you're in real life, it's inappropriate.
Right.
And especially within friendships, stuff like that, you shouldn't be thinking at that level. Have a good time. And that's, I mean, honestly, I think that's, it's very of the moment, I think. And,
right.
And also, it does say a lot. I personally, it agrees with my cynical views of the media, specifically the news media. And so I agreed with the film quite often, so maybe that's why I loved it so much, and that's
right. It uses a very specific world of late night exploitation journalism,
right?
But it's, if you think about it, you know, and you don't have to think about it very hard, it's an it branches out to basically just the world of exploitative media in general. Then that could be the 24-hour news cycle. That could be reality TV. That could be a lot of things. It could be Hollywood itself. And you know, there's plenty of shots in this movie, and there's plenty of dialogue in this movie to suggest that that the movie is a little bit about, you know, sort of a Peeping Tom-esque deconstruction of the Hollywood genre film.
In a way, I can see where you're going. I mean, I'm more attached to the cynical worldview, but
right. And this is dark. This is one of the most misanthropic movies I've seen since Gone Girl, and even more so than that.
Yeah. I mean, you don't... I think you feel it more in Gone Girl, but because of the rock and roll attitude... Because I also... The other movie that we didn't bring up, Blowout. But sure. But it's like if the Jake Gyllenhaal character was John Lithgow's character and John Travolta's character at the same time.
Right.
And there was no bad guy.
Right.
You know, and I don't know, the film. Yeah. Oh, it's just great on all levels.
Everyone should go out and see this movie. I know that the trailers were not very good because they were they didn't want to give away what it was. And, you know, that's in one way really great because it made the movie all the more exciting because I had no fuck idea where it was going to go from scene to scene. But it also kind of disserviced the film because nobody knew what it was. But, you know, without giving away too much, I think this is one of the most impressive movies I've seen this year, easily. And I think it does and says all the things Gone Girl was trying to do with a lot more efficiency. Not to, you know, put down that movie at all. I thought it was great. And the two are kind of interesting to be seen together. But I do think that this kind of is a little bit more of an honest, hard and dirty approach to basically the same ideas.
Maybe. I mean, I see what you're saying, and there is a lot of interconnectivity and a lot of, definitely almost a similar world. But yeah. This is like, this could be like a Marvel Universe type films, right? that they could put together. But
the way I look at it is, if you really wanted to, you could condense both movies into 15-minute Sin City shorts. You know what I mean?
Almost. Well, yeah, I mean, you would definitely lose the
effectiveness of both.
The effectiveness
but that's the world they come from.
The smartness. But yeah, no, they're definitely playing in a genre. I'm not denying that at all. But I think both films are very smart. And this one, yeah, I can't praise it. It's just going to be me being a fangirl for the next, like, 10 minutes. I just love this film. Like,
I do,
really.
Too. I want to see it again before it's out of theaters because I feel like it's going to get booted out here pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And which is another reason why I'm telling people, see it as soon as you can, because it actually did get a wide release considering how dark and misanthropic it is.
But I think it's because it uses the genre, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's a little easier for people to swallow something like that when you wrap it up in something. It's a subversive, the film is subversive as shit too. Everyone should go see this film. Just stop listening right now.
Right.
Go to the theater. I don't care if it's like 12 at night. Line up. Go see the movie.
All right. And let's go ahead and get into our final review, which is the Netflix homework, which you had assigned me last week, The American Scream. And I'll let you set that up.
Yeah. Okay. So this was a documentary that basically follows three different people in this Fairhaven, Massachusetts, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Basically they follow these three different households that put on these big haunts at Halloween time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a documentary. I'm going to assume they're real people.
I think they probably are. Yeah.
This is done by the guy that did the best worst film ever.
Okay. I didn't know that. That kind of makes sense because they both sort of deal with, similar ideas of sort of like, everyday quirky America.
Well, they do that, but I feel like the ideas in this film kind of, I actually really like this film. Mm-hmm. I think that it's, And it's one of few films that uses sentimentality, but I like it.
I think it sometimes, not all the time, sentimentality.
Uh-huh.
I think sometimes in a documentary, not all the time, but sometimes in a documentary, it can work better because it's a little harder to fake.
What I think is interesting is I do think that there's an idea fused into this documentary too. It's not just, and it's not pushing an issue on you, and it's not beating you over the head. I think it's literally talking about, like, you know, about people creating, and right. You know, and we're not talking high end, you know, the Stephen Kings or the, you know, the Christopher Nolans, and I'm not trying to disparage him, but what I'm saying, or either of those people, I'm just saying that it's talking about, you know, people at ground level creating, and the financial situation. Yeah. And so I tend to really like this film. I attach to it, and I think it's a good little documentary.
No, I do too. It has very interesting documentary subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And you could criticize the movie, or at least I did initially when we're being introduced to the different subjects, mm-hmm. because they seem to become increasingly less functional as the movie went. Right. They start to get weirder and quirkier and weirder and quirkier, and you could feel like there's a little bit of kind of Hollywood snobbery, kind of looking down at the flyover state type of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you get enough of an idea of these people and enough of a feel of them by the end of the movie that it doesn't really feel like it's doing that anymore.
See, and I think you can
honey boo booing all of them.
No, they're not at all. I think if it would have ended in a certain way and it was just exploitation, mm-hmm. Then it would be one thing. But no, I think that there's a real love for the people that they met. The two specifically, that they are kind of strange characters, but I think that it shows them in a rather kind of warm light, even though they do have flaws.
Right, the father-son character.
Yeah, the clowns. The clown.
Right, was terrifying, by the way. Just
the clowns or them as people? Because I thought
them,
that...
them as clowns, specifically. It's just they...
oh, okay.
I mean, more scary than, you know, the stuff that they mean to be scary. But no, it's very much kind of a small documentary. It's like a Best Worst Movie, actually, very similar in construction. And I think that it does talk a little bit about sort of like the financial crisis and like people, you know, instead of creating a really financial secure desk job kind of life, you're kind of given an option to follow your dream instead, but you're gambling everything on it. And I think that story is very relevant to a lot of people. I don't know. It's there's a lot of warmth here.
Yeah, and I actually, to be honest, like re-seeing it, because uh-huh. this is the second time I saw the movie, I wanted to watch it with Jackie because I thought she'd like it as well.
Yeah.
I actually, you know, I liked it more. So I actually think that it's just a pretty warm, friendly documentary. It's not shoving any propaganda down your throat, don't think. And it's not, and I don't think it's manipulative.
No.
I think it's an honest, just good little documentary. I liked it. So.
Right. And I think there's kind of a general fascination that people have with people who make stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the watching somebody make something or create something on film is just a innately cinematic thing, whether it's in a documentary or not. So there's lots of stuff there. Like, you know, if you're into like those like Project Runway or the horror makeup version of that show, like if you're into like that type of stuff, I think there's a lot here to enjoy. It's like them making their props and how they're going to set them up. And, you know, if you really want to get deep into it, you could see that as a little bit of self-reflexive, drawing the parallels between these guys who are putting on these big productions and, like, you know, sort of what it's like to be on a film set.
Yeah. And they literally mentioned that.
Yeah.
At one point in the film. And I, you know, I think that it kind of demystifies it. And it's like, yeah, the people who create stuff are just people. And they're trying to feed their families and do like I don't know. It's just, it's a warm, nice documentary. It also, like, I mean, a lot of people want to look at you know? I think it's also what it does is it kind of lends a voice to, like, oh, people who are into horror, it's, you know, they're weirdos. No, they're just normal people.
Yeah, although the guy, the main documentary subject, whose name I can't remember, but the one who puts a lot of effort into it and, you know, prepares all year and all that stuff, he has this, like, kind of, like, preteen daughter who's, like, you know, she's going to be a goth chick in high school, you know it. And she's in, you know, she's going to be, like, one of those, like, sleep that... tattoo, like, heavy metal girls and when she gets older. And there's a really nice little moment where she's, you know, she's helping her dad and she gets really into it also. And there's a nice moment where she's showing her these plans for this prop that they want to build. And it's this, you know, this hand coming out from under a bed and they're going over it. And the dad says, oh, so this isn't a monster from coming out from under the bed. This is a victim who's getting pulled under the bed. And she's like, yeah. And he's like, you're a sick little girl, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, no, but it kind of exposes the fun, the fantasy element of horror. And that's something that, I mean, so in a way it kind of analyzes, I think this film does a lot because I think that that was kind of the filmmaker's way of going into the documentary is to be more of a mirror.
Right.
Than be like, this is the issue. This is what it is. This is what I'm shoving at you, you know, is to kind of go in there and be like, here, these are the different things. And then edit something together to kind of give you different parts of what it is. So yeah, just a pleasant little documentary.
All right. The movie that I am going to assign you next week, and I'm just going to make sure it's on Netflix real fast. Yes, it is. I know that you were talking about going into the back catalog of Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to go for the most obvious one, but I think one that is a good entry point is anything.
Okay.
The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Purple Rose of Cairo. Okay.
And I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about that next week.
Okay. Sometimes when you say it like that, I fear a little bit. I'm like, is he setting me up? What is this?
It's a trick. It's a trap.
That's how I feel most weeks. Yes.
If anybody has anything they want to say about any of the movies we talked about this week, whether it be Interstellar, did it work for you? Did you cry? I'm interested to hear it. Nightcrawler, if you haven't seen it, please do. American Scream.
Did you cry?
Did you cry?
I kind of did.
I bet you did. You can email, going back to my thing, you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, as I mentioned before. We're also on Twitter, at jabberpodcast is where you can find us there. And I believe that Quarter Life Crisis in the last couple of weeks have added more Facebook followers than we have and Twitter followers, so we have to beat them now. It's officially a competition.
I think they'll win. They seem more friendly than we are.
Maybe that's true. Our regular archives can be found at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, where you can also find our RSS feed. You can listen to us on Stitcher Radio and iTunes and Pocket Cast and listen to us on your favorite mobile device. When you're on Stitcher and iTunes, please leave us a one sentence review and a star rating. You can read my movie reviews that I do every week for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also find me every once in a while at Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can read Richard's stuff that he does over his blog at rdwally.weebly.com. And if you have to, I guess you can listen to Quarter Life Crisis over at quartercrisis.podbean.com.
Definitely don't like their stuff, though. Like our stuff.
Like our stuff first. And then if you have to, you can like their stuff
well,
as well.
Check how many likes they have. And if they have more than we do.
Maybe you can wait.
Yeah. Just wait.
Uh-huh. Also, be sure to check out Dampercast over there, our friend Leland. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Ciao.
Bye.
I regret that immediately.